Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 15th day of Teivet. Thank you to Rabbi Jacob Bramowitz, to David Hackhauser, and to the OU for making this shiurim available to you online. And today, for the 15th of Teivet, we're going to see three different short tshuvot, all of which I think surround a little bit of a theme, which is of halachot, that we think the halacha goes one way, and then it ends up going another way in ways that I think are surprising and interesting. So the Chatam Sofer is from the first Chemek Aleph in the Orach Chaim section, Simon Kuf, 1-100, and it's from the 15th day of Teivet of the year Tov Kuf Tzadi Hei 1835. Question was, let's say somebody comes across a bird's nest on Shabbos. So birds on Shabbos are certainly muktzah. So you're not usually allowed to touch and carry and move birds on Shabbos. So the question is, you know, maybe though, if I'm obligated to, on a Torah level, to send away the mother bird and take the baby birds, then I have to do it because it's a Torah obligation. And I don't know that Chazal told me, don't fulfill this Torah obligation because of the obligation of muktzah. So that was the question. Chazal Sofer says, and this is actually, I think, a fairly well-known tshuva, on once you start talking about the issue of Shiluach HaKain, about sending away the mother bird and taking the baby birds, there's a, I think, the beginning source that people quote often, and the Chazal Sofer quotes here, is a Chavot Yair, who was from a few hundred years before the Chatam Sofer. I think he's from the 17th century, so the 1600s, so about 200 years beforehand, in Simon Samach Zayin, response number 67, talks about the exact question of, is the obligation to send away a mother bird an independent obligation, meaning I come across a bird's nest, I'm required to send away the mother bird and take the baby birds, or is it a requirement that if I want the baby birds, I have to make sure not to be the kind of a person who takes the mother as well? There are two different ways of looking, meaning, you know, if I say to you, is there an obligation to shecht animals, to slaughter animals? The answer is, there is an obligation, if one wants to eat meat, to slaughter animals. But there's no obligation to go off and make sure to eat meat so you can slaughter animals, right? On the other hand, there's an obligation to shake a lulav on Sukkot. That's an obligation. So the question with Shiluach HaKain is that the Chavot Yair already raised is, what kind of an obligation is it? Is it an obligation of, I see a mother bird with her baby birds, I have to send away the mother bird and take the baby birds? Or is it an obligation that if I come across a nest and I want the baby birds, I want the chicks, or I want the eggs, that then I have to send away the mother bird before I'm allowed to take them? Now, one significant source was the Gemara in Chulin, Kuf Lamed Tet Amud Bet 139b in Chulin, says, could it be that you have to run into the mountains looking for birds' nests to take them, to take away the baby birds and send away the mother birds and take the baby birds? So the Gemara says, no, the Pasuk says, Talmud Lomar Ki Karei Kan Sipor. It says, when you happen upon a bird's nest. So that sounds like it would be an independent obligation that whenever you find a bird's nest, that you have to start doing it. It's just that you're not required to go into the mountains to look for it. But anytime you find it, you should. But later on in Chulin, Kuf Mem Beis, a page later in Chulin 140b, he talks about if you have two rows of eggs, one on top of the other, and Tosus there says you want to take the bottom one, so then already it's not clear that you have to send away the mother bird, but it shows that the fact that the whole discussion about what you do or don't do in that situation, and that it's a question of whether or not you have to send away the mother bird, it shows though that if you don't take any of the babies, any of the eggs, any of the chicks, any of the baby birds, you don't have to take them. That also seems to us. Rashi gives us contradictory indications. So you'd have to look up this Gemara in Chulin. Rashi says, if you found a nest, if you found the mother when she's in the middle of giving birth to laying eggs, so then, and most of the eggs have already come out, then you have to send away the mother bird, and it sounds like there, where the Rashi says it, that it's not a function of whether you want it or not, you just have to do it. And so too the Gemara there sounds that way, but elsewhere it says different. So Rashi's inconclusive. Now that Rashi is talking about also a Gemara that talks about what the extent to which sending away the mother bird has to be, meaning Rashi reads the Gemara to understand that in order to properly fulfill the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKain, let's assume for a second that you want to fulfill the mitzvah, and you want the egg. That's what you want. You want the eggs or the chicks. So you're going to send away the mother bird. How do you have to do it? Rashi's understanding of the Gemara is that you have to actually take hold of the mother bird and throw it away or throw it off so that it goes and flies off and goes away. But the Rambam, tell you, I got it the exact reverse. Rashi makes it sound there like when they talk, there's a Gemara that talks about taking it by its wings and taking it by its legs and throwing it off. Rashi understands that Gemara to mean that it does not to mean it literally, and that even if you can effectively send the mother away, a bird away, without touching it, that you're allowed to do that. But the Rambam thinks that no, that Gemara is saying you have to actually take hold of the mother bird and throw it away. And that will come up just a little bit later. We're almost done with the tshuva. It's a very brief tshuva. It'll come up a little bit later to be relevant. So let's put that aside for a second. The question of the way in which Shiluach HaKein is fulfilled is this. But another proof that he brings about the fact that you do or don't have to do it is that the Gemara in Mishnah at the end of Chulin talks about what about how we should notice, like some things about the Torah. Ma mitzvah kalak isa. There's a mitzvah that's not even, doesn't even cost us an isar of money. Aval hi hitila Torah chiyuv l'chol haroa kein. If the obligation was that anytime you see a nurse, you have to do it, and there's no hefset at all in it because you're going to always be doing it. It's not an issue, and therefore that sounds like you're not required to. Moving on to other sources, the Ramban in Chumash talks about, this is a Ramban when the Torah talks about the mitzvah Shiluach HaKein, the Ramban mentions that the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim gave one reason. He gave it, first of all, the Rambam, one of the Rambam's, not quite an innovation, one of the things that's connected to him because he said it most explicitly and elaborately, is that we are allowed to imagine and to think and to understand that there are rationales for mitzvot that we can understand, not that we can base our observance of the mitzvah on whether we agree with the rationale or not, or whether the rationale makes sense to us or not, but that we can operate as if there are rationales to mitzvot. Since we can operate there as if there are rationales to mitzvot, we also can work to understand those rationales. And the Rambam gives one rationale for Shiluach HaKein, and the Ramban accepts it, and the Sefer HaChinuch and the mitzvah also, that they all seem to think that the mitzvah has to do with us not becoming akzariyim. Now, in modern Hebrew, akzari has the connotation of cruel, but I think there's also a lesser connotation of it being insensitive or hard-hearted, which is not necessarily the same thing as cruel. Right? Cruel is when I actively do terrible things to people. Hard-hearted is I see people suffering and I don't, it doesn't matter to me so much. That's and akzari can be that lower level as well as already an akzari. So you take the mother with the birds, you can say, well, they don't really care, but in doing so, in taking a whole family at once and destroying this mother's legacy in front of her eyes, and this isn't really necessarily a function of us assuming that the animals really have these feelings. Some, the Rambam does assume that animals have these feelings, and that's part of the situation, but I think the Ramban thinks that it could be about us, regardless of whether they actually have these feelings, that it's a thing for us. And that's despite the fact that the Rambam paskin, we paskin, that you can't in davening say, al kan tzipor yagiu rachamecha. You can't say, as a part of a praise of Hashem, that Hashem's rachamim, Hashem's mercies and compassions even extend to the nest of a bird. Meaning you might say, well, if Hashem wants us not to be hard-hearted to a mother and her babies and her eggs, that shows that Hashem is rachamim for them. So that we argue that you're not allowed to say, because we're not allowed to say such things about Hashem. But even so, we are allowed to say that there are rationales to mitzvot such that we can understand how they're meant to affect us, and that would be affecting us, that we shouldn't become akzariyim. If that's true, however, points out the Chatam Sofer, then it would be highly unusual, if not illogical, if not insane, to imagine that even if we don't care anything about taking the eggs and the birds, every time we come and stumble across a nest, we have to do it. How can you say such a thing? Meaning, it's one thing if you say to me, I have some need for eggs. I'm a person, I eat eggs. People are allowed to eat eggs. And if I need eggs, and I come across a nest, and the mother is there, and I need the eggs. So the halach is, and the Torah is, the world is in some sense made for people to use, and the animal kingdom is available in certain ways for people to make use of it. That's all good. So therefore, I'm allowed to take eggs. So there the Torah tells me, make sure that you send away the mother bird before you take the eggs. That's fully understandable. But if the idea is not to turn that we should learn not to be hard-hearted to other sufferings, than to imagine that we would create situations of sufferings and then reduce it by sending away the mother bird, that would be very strange. And that's the Chatam Sofer's real understanding of the Torah halacha of Shiluach HaKein, that based on the way the Rambam and the Ramban and the Sefer HaChinuch, so the Chatam Sofer was thought was written by the Ra'ah, and I think today we don't think that for various reasons, but the Sefer HaChinuch is an important Rishon of that time. It's a Rishon of just the generation right after the Ramban, and quotes the Ramban and quotes the Rambam, and these are very authoritative sources. They all make clear their understanding that the mitzvah Shiluach HaKein is about us developing ourselves in a certain way, and if you're going to make it into an absolute obligation, every time you come across a nest, you have to do it, then you're like subverting the entire purpose of it, it would seem. Now, in Tamei Mitzvah, it's important to point out that if we had clear and distinct sources that said, no, this is the mitzvah, then you wouldn't say, well, the reason I came up with says that, that can't be the mitzvah. You would say, I have to find other reasons for it. The Rachatzim Sefer's point isn't that the reason means that it can't be the mitzvah. It's that if those Rishonim could give that as the reason, they clearly understood the mitzvah not to include circumstances that would be subverting what they understood to be the purpose, because of that, they wouldn't have suggested that purpose for it, and that was going on. And the Chacham Tzvi also says, the Rachatzim Sefer, the Chacham Tzvi also is very clear, there's no obligation to take the chicks or the eggs, and when it says you should take the chicks or the eggs for you, the children for you, it's like when the Torah says, and I thought this was interesting because it's not clear to me that this is true, it's like when the Torah says, is there any actual obligation that I have to, you know, turn on lights during the week, I have to violate the Isurim, the Melachot of Shabbat during the week? There's no real such obligation. I mean, somebody said to me, listen, there's a Melacha to, you know, plant. I'm not going to plant during the week or on Shabbat because I don't like planting. So there's no violation of the Torah when you say, well, the Torah said you have to work all week. Usually, generally, almost always, we do actions of Melacha during the week, but there's no, that's the Chacham Tzvi said, and he said, that's the way the Torah meant Abaniti Kachlach, means if you have a need or if you have a desire, then you take it. So that's the thrust of the way the Chacham Sefer understood this situation. But then he points out that the Tshuvas Chavos Yair throws in a curveball at the end. There was a tradition in the name of the Zohar. Let's remember the Zohar is a Kabbalistic work that appears in Jewish history after the time of the Sefer, or right around the time of the Sefer HaChinuch, meaning the Ramban passes away in 1260 or 1263. I always get that mixed up. Somewhere in that area. And the Zohar, I think the first examples we have, or the first knowledge we have of the Zohar in Jewish history is like 20, 25 years later than that. So the Zohar comes and says, no, the mitzvah of Shiluch HaKein is le'orer yililat ima ila'a al baneha. It's to arouse the compassions and the cries of the ima ilah. So the ima ilah is a Kabbalistic concept. It's a mystical idea that in heaven, in some sense, wherever heaven is, because heaven isn't like up, but in heaven, in the celestial realms, right, in the realms of the metaphysical realms, there is an attribute of the world that's sort of our mother in some way. And that attribute of that, when that attribute cries out to Hashem that the Jewish people are suffering, that sort of gets more compassion to Hashem. If you understand the mitzvah that way, then the mitzvah is that we are told by the Torah to use the incident of encountering a nest with the mother and its babies, and by forcing the mother away, which in some sense causes that mother bird to call out, that calling out by the mother bird will also call out, lead to the calling out of the mother Elah, the heavenly mother to the Jewish people, whatever those words mean. But the important part of it is that would mean that it's something to be done independent of whether or not I happen to want these eggs or these birds, because it's not about the animals. The animals are small players in a metaphysical Kabbalistic game, and that metaphysical Kabbalistic game is a very important one. And then it also means, by the way, he says, that we're not being hard-hearted in doing it, because it's not that we're being ignoring the suffering of the birds, it's that this suffering of the birds momentarily is important for some larger purpose, meaning, let's say, you know, somebody, God forbid, has an infection, or they have a growth that has to come off. You wouldn't say that cutting off the growth is a chazariyut, is hard-hearted. It's what you need to do because it's going to get to a much better end. And in this reading of the mitzvah, that would be what happened as well, that you need to cause this momentary suffering to the birds in order that the whole world should get along better, because the ima ilah will produce rachamim for the Jewish people. So that would answer all the problems. So there's no specific problem with the Zohar's reading. And then the Chatam Sofer, and this is the Chatam Sofer, is the 1800s. The Chatam Sofer comes from a Kabbalistic background in many ways. He had Rebbeim who were Kabbalist, and he's certainly not somebody who completely denies Kabbalah in any way. But then he points out a principle that is not remembered as often as it could be, that was very clear. When our Gemara says something very clearly, he says, a kochach shas dilan lo sphere like a Zohar anal. Our Gemara doesn't hold like that Zohar, because if it did, the Rambam, the Ramban, and the Ra wouldn't say what they did. The Chasid Rechinuch wouldn't say what they said. Via dua heka de plige hanigle manistar. It's well known that whenever the exoteric, the plain Torah, the plain halacha, without Kabbalistic meanings or derivations or insights, says one thing, and the Nistar Halacha, however that comes about, the Kabbalistic sources, you know, you find an Ari, you find the Zohar, as in this case, say something else, we follow the Niglot. We follow the open, obvious, plain Torah. That's actually, as I'm taping this, it's in this week's parsha. It's in my this week's parsha. It's parsha Nitzavim, Hanistarol Hashem Elokeinu, which we usually mean as, you know, sins that people are committing in private. But he's reading it as also Nistarot, the Kabbalistic ways of the world. That's for Hashem to work on. V'haniglot lanu v'adir. It's our job to work on the niglot. So if you want to work on Nistarot also, that's fine, except where those Nistarot, those Kabbalistic, mystical, esoteric issues, get in the way of plain and simple halak. Now, it is true, he says. So that would be a reason why we would follow the Rambam and the Ramban, and we would assume that the mitzvah is not an absolute mitzvah. It's only a mitzvah if I happen to want the eggs, or I want the birds, and I want the chicks, then I have to do it. Val kolpanim, letamoshal zohar, when you go according to the Zohar, if you were going to follow that reasoning, so if there were people out there who said, you know what, I believe in the Zohar so fully, I think you're allowed to follow it, even when it contradicts plain, ordinary halacha. Or you might claim that in this situation, the plain, ordinary halacha isn't as explicit as the Chazal Sofer is presenting it, whatever it is. He says, if you were going to do that, then you still have a bit of a problem. Because according to the Rambam, you have to grab the bird itself. So that creates certain problems, meaning it's not now a problem of... I'm sorry, according to the Torah of the Zohar, you couldn't do it on Shabbos, he says, first of all, because it's la'orir yilala ila. You're trying to get the bird to cry, the mother bird to cry, so that the ima ila, the heavenly mother, will cry. But we don't do that on Shabbos. We don't cause yilalot on Shabbat. Not only that, going back into a little bit more prosaic halakha, we mentioned before that the rabbi holds that you have to take hold of the bird and throw it away, the mother bird. So how do you get that? How do you catch the mother bird? You have to grab it. Well, grabbing a bird on Shabbos is a problem. If it's a bird that's already in captivity, it's in a cage, let's say, that's a derabbanan issue. The bird itself is not being caught. It's already caught, so there's no tzeda, there's no hunting, but there's a muktza issue. But if the bird's out there in the world, I'm walking along, so it's not only a muktza issue, it's a tzeda issue. I'm capturing a bird. You're not allowed to capture animals on Shabbat. That's one of the 39 melachot. So that would be another reason. So for Rashi, you could theoretically, if you were to say, well, I follow the Zohar, and I'm going to get rid of the mother, but I'm only going to get rid of the mother by scaring the mother, so that you're not going to touch the mother at all. So then there would be room to do that, because you wouldn't be violating anything, and you wouldn't be touching anything. But other than that, you've got a problem. But again, he says that I don't really hold this stuff, and I don't really get involved in this stuff, and that's why he clearly thinks the mitzvah Shiluach HaKan, which today comes up as an issue, because there are people today who will quote the Zohar version of it, and they'll say, no, you should just do the mitzvah whenever you come across it. And I think what the Chassam Sofer says is true, that the consensus before the Zohar came along, and even after the Zohar came along, you look at the Tshuva and the Chavos Yair, he mentions the Zohar, and the Chavos Yair is not willing to say, well, you can ignore the Zohar, but the Chassam Sofer is pretty clear that he thinks that in halachic issues, we'll follow the plain halacha rather than Zohar halacha, which would mean that if somebody needs or wants the birds or eggs, then they do the mitzvah shiluch. Okay, and then on Shabbos, it's not clear that you would do it, because according to the Rabbim, you'd have to throw away the mother egg, and also you'd have muktzah issues, and it's not clear and those would seem to get in the way, because you don't have any absolute obligation to do it, so therefore we wouldn't do it on Shabbos or Yom Tov. That's our first tshuva of the day, reminding us that for all that today, at least, you can hear people talk about the mitzvah Shiluach HaKan as if it's a mitzvah that has to happen, and that you have to do it when you come across it, and there's a value and to do it independent of your interest in or desire for the babies or the chicks or the eggs. Chazal Sofer says the consensus of Allah seems to be not that that's not true. Tshuva number two is a tshuva. It's a brief tshuva. It's Shuta Hayelah for the Chashtamor of Shlomo Kluger, who we've never had a chance. I don't think we've had a chance before to learn from, but he has Shuta Hayelah for Chashtamor. So it's called Shutu. He and other people like him who do this. He called every book we've encountered Meshivim, who will speak, and you'll talk about. Let's say the Nodu Behud comes in Mahadura Kama and Mahadura Tinyana, a first edition and the later edition. The later edition isn't a redone edition. The first, it's like the later volume of it. Today we would call it volumes 1, 2, 3, and 4. You didn't always do that. You might call it a first edition, a later edition, something along those lines. But other Meshivim, every time they came out with a new book, they would call it a new name. So Shlomo Kluger has many, many books. I have no idea of all the names of the books, but he is also the author of a book of Tshuvot called Tuv Tam Vadat, which is, again, just the name that he gave to his volume of response. So in Ha'elef L'chash Shlomo, which means 1,000 to Shlomo, it's a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, in the Ebenezer section, Siman Kuf Yud Chet, response number 118, this is a tshuva written in on the 15th of Tevet of 1852, Tof Reish Yud Gimel. I just want to mention about Shlomo Kluger, an interesting thing about him. He was born in 1785 in Poland, and he passed away there in 1869, and for the last 50 years of his life and more, he was the rabbi of Brod, meaning in his 30s, he got to a town, he became the rav there, and he stayed there for the rest of his life, and he had a very productive life there as the rav of the town. So he's writing a letter to a guy, and the issue we'll get to in a second, but it's clear in the letter that there's a little bit of tension between these two men, because he opens the letter by saying, the fact that you said that I'm a Toei B'dvar Mishnah. Toei B'dvar Mishnah is actually a pretty big insult. The Toei B'dvar Mishnah in the Gemara is a standard where the person who ruled on a certain situation made such a big mistake, he made a mistake that the answer to his question is literally explicit in the Mishnah, and the Mishnah, the way it says it, is in fact halakha, and this guy got it wrong. That's a Toei B'dvar Mishnah. Such a mistake that in certain Gemaras, it seems like that might not even count as a mistake that the as a mistake, because it's so obviously wrong that everybody should have just known it and ignored it and never paid attention to it to begin with. In this case, the D'var Mishnah that was in question was the fact that Shlomo Kluger had said that a husband can't force his wife to move to Eretz Yisrael, can't force his wife to move to Israel. That's the background. It's not in this tshuva, but that's the background. That's the clear background. The man writing him says, what are you talking about? It's a mission in Ketubot. Says, you can. So Rav Shlomo Kluger now answers back with a little sharpness of his own. He says, it's not true. That's not what I wrote. And usually I write things briefly, and I trust that the people that I'm writing to are bright enough. He doesn't say bright enough. He says, l'smoch al mevin midata, that the person will understand on their own. So now, since I've come to realize, this is the subtext, since I've come to realize that you're not smart enough, I'll explain to you. He says, first of all, just look around you. If it were true that the halacha is clearly and obviously that you have to make aliyah, and this is an issue that comes up, you know, that this his tshuva was being written in 1852. We can ask that question again in 2017, right, which is Tov Shinai in Zion. We can ask that question again, and some of these you can mention here are relevant if you want to ask the question again, but we're not going to today. We're just going to learn from the tshuva. He says, back then he says, if in 1852, in Tov Reish Yud Gimel, if it's a clear halacha that you can force people to make aliyah, why don't all the Hasidic Rebbes make aliyah? Which I think is an excellent question. And he says, certainly they can make aliyah. They have the wherewithal to make aliyah, especially, he says, the Rishon Rebbe. I think he mentioned the Rishon Rebbe because the guy he's writing to, who I didn't keep his name here, but I think I looked it up one time, the guy he's writing to was actually a known guy to a known chassid of the Rishon Rebbe, who I think made aliyah and built settlements in Israel, and there was like a whole background there to that. But he's saying to him, if you're so correct that aliyah is such an obvious obligation, how come all of your so he mentions the Hasidic Rebbe's because this guy was a Hasid, especially of the Rishoner. So how did he go to Eretz Yisrael? So it's got to be that people today have assumed, this is back then, have assumed that we follow the opinion that nowadays there's no specific obligation, by obligation meaning no obligation where if you don't do it, you're failing to fulfill an obligation. Everybody has always agreed that if you move to Israel and you live in Israel, that's fulfilling important mitzvot, discussion of its own. But whether or not, just like the question of Shiluch HaKan, when you encounter an est, you have to do it. Is it an actual obligation on every Jew to move to Israel? In 1852, Shlomo Kluger is saying it's got to be that we all tend to assume that there's not. Now, why would we assume that there's not? Before we get to that in a second, he's saying, and then you have to say step two is that Mishnah that says you can force your wife, either spouse, can force the spouse to make aliyah, that would only be, and again, the Mishnah doesn't actually say that, but it's a reasonable, it's a plausible reading of it, for sure. That would only be where, A, there's a mitzvah to do it, and B, another additional principle, where they have enough money to make the trip. And they're not going to have to take tzedakah to make the trip. But to say that a poor person can force his wife to go on aliyah, they're poor, they're just making it where they are, but you can force them, they don't even have enough trip for the money for the trip, they're going to have to beg, you know, or borrow, whatever they're going to have to do. So we have a principle in halacha that's so nematano. You get it. You don't take tzedakah if you don't have to. And there's a Gemara where Chazal say it's better to have a Shabbos that's much closer to a weekday than to fulfill the mitzvah of oneg Shabbos by borrowing money by taking charity to right. So let's say somebody has enough money, let's say for Bir Lecha Mishnah and for lighting candles or for Kiddush, and no more than that, sadly for them. So do they have to take charity to have a better Shabbos? So the Shlomo Kluger says, the Gemara seems to say, it's better to have a Shabbos that's not so distinguished in its own Shabbos than to take charity. Complicated issue of its own. I'm not saying that he's ruling on that issue. I'm just pointing out that the resistance to taking charity is sufficient that if he wants to force her to make aliyah, and to make aliyah they're going to have to take money, they're going to take charity to be able to get there, Then there's no reason to do so. And then, not only that, they're going to take charity once they get there. Rav Goldberg says, you think that's another problem because you've got already poor people in Eretz Yisrael. And the poor people in Eretz Yisrael barely get by on the donations that are collected. There's all these collections that go on. People send money to the poor of Eretz Yisrael. And if he comes in he adds him and his wife to the list of the poor people of Eretz Yisrael, he's cutting into their funds, and he thinks that's masig gvul. Masig gvul means when somebody has an established business or other kind of financial arrangement, and I cut into it, so that's also not allowed. So that would be other issues. But then, the whole mitzvah of Aliyah, Rabbeinu Tamid held, Rabbeinu Tamid was writing in the late 1000s, early 1100s, he held that nowadays, and the definition of nowadays is what to think about, he said you can't make Aliyah, you don't have an absolute obligation to make Aliyah, because there are so many mitzvot, hatliot ba'aretz, there are many important mitzvot that are connected to the land of Israel, like about growing things, you know, tithing things, truma and maser, shmita issues, as we've seen in our times, he says, and nobody really knows how to fulfill them properly, and therefore going on aliyah might be, Rabbeinu Tam said, self-defeating. Because you'll get there and there'll be all these things that you're not doing right. Now, I would just point out, this is not Shlomo Kluger, I would point out that after Rabbeinu Tam wrote, and since Shlomo Kluger wrote, we've actually seen a time when, in the late 1890s, and I recorded this as one of our responses, I forget which day, Rav Cook started thinking about these issues and he saw them as a skula for making Aliyah, and then he eventually made Aliyah, and he worked hard on many of these issues, and others as well, including especially also the Chazon Ish, worked very hard, and Rav Yechiel Mechel Tukachinsky worked hard on very issues of living in Israel, how you do and don't live in Israel in proper ways. So in all of those issues, we today, I think, are living in a different time than Rabbeinu Tam in the time of his plaque. So I think today, that would be a new conversation to have. Rabbeinu Tam posked a certain way. I don't need to question Rabbeinu Tam's psak and its correctness in its own time to wonder whether it's still true today, since we've had the benefit of important and great rabbis who have gone ahead and founded and done investigations, done hard work on these mitzvot. Then in the time of Rabbeinu Tam, Rabbeinu Chaim Cohen also had said that the ways are very dangerous. And that's another reason that was given by the Tosafists to say that Aliyah was not an absolute obligation. And especially poor people, meaning rich people, they'll get on a boat, and the boat will go, and they'll, but poor people will probably have to take a circuitous route because they won't be able to afford all at once to pay for this or this, and they're going to have to do that, then they're going to have even more danger. And if danger is an excuse, a valid excuse, not an excuse, a valid reason to not make Aliyah, then they have those reasons, and therefore his ability to force her would be significantly reduced, if not would disappear altogether, because they can't do it in a safe way, and there's no evidence that you have to endanger yourself on the road in order to be able to make Aliyah. Not only that, he says also that when the husband married her, there was an implicit understanding that they were going to live wherever she lived, because that's the general understanding in marriage of their time, that you get married and you live where the wife lives, or maybe you live where the husband lives. But there's no understanding at all that you're going to think about or plan on making Aliyah. Right now, it is true that the Mishnah says you can force people, but that's because the Rav Shlomo Kluger assumes in the time of the Mishnah, in the time of the Gemara, enough people moved to Israel, and you'd have to check the history of this to be sure if we were convinced by it enough, but enough people were making Aliyah that it was a live option. And therefore, when they got married, it was a live option. That's the way he's understanding it. Whereas today, where very few people make Aliyah in 1852, it's not as live an option. Therefore, he thinks that Mishnah would not be enforced halachically. And then he closes by saying, so you clearly didn't understand me correctly, and that's how it is. So that's a second issue where Shlomo Kluger says, for all that you read the Mishnah easily as saying that you have to make Aliyah, and that a husband can force his wife to make Aliyah, you look around more, there's more complications to it, and I have just thrown in along the way that some of those complications that he's raising have changed since then, and therefore you'd have to reevaluate that in our times. And once again, almost every day that I say we're going to have, two or three, because they're so short, I end up running out of time, and there's this tshuva of Igros Moshe Yeridea 2:122, Bet Kuf Chaf Bet, that I really can't completely leave. So I'll take, I hope only 2 minutes, but probably a little bit more, to go through that a little bit. And the other question was, you have a baby. The question is, could they call a baby a girl by the name of, I think, an aunt who had passed away young at the age of 28. This is a question from Tevav Tevet, the 15th of Tevet, of Tavshin Kafket of 1968. Now, as I said, I unfortunately don't have enough time to go through the whole discussion, but Moshe Feinstein points out there is an issue in halacha with naming people after people who had been killed in some kind of a violent way. There we worry about what's called Ria Mazaleh. We worry that something about their life story went wrong in some kind of an obvious way, and therefore we try not to do it. So, for example, that's why even though Yeshayahu as a prophet is always referred to as Yeshayahu, the Yamshel Shlomo, the Maharshal, said the tradition is to call people, not Yeshayahu, we call them Yeshaya. We call them Yeshaya to change the name a little bit. We're not calling them exactly that name. We're only calling that. And the same thing comes up with Gedaliahu as opposed to Gedalia. And those are two people who got killed. Now, those are also very important people, and that might change the calculus. It might be that you'd say that you can name after them somewhat, even though they had such hard lives. Now, there, though, it's not that they died young, it's that they got killed. And I have to say, the most interesting thing to me about the tshuva is that Rav Moshe Feinstein says, but if it's somebody who passed away a natural death, he's just not sure that that counts as ria mazaleh, as evidence that this person had some kind of a negative life karma. You know, karma is not the right word at all, but negative life fortune that we wouldn't want to put onto the baby, because maybe that's as long as Hashem wanted them in the world. And I find that such an interesting concept, because it's a reminder that from a position of faith, it's not always true that long life is what was destined for somebody. It might be true. Rav Moshe Feinstein, he's not saying it's absolutely sure, but it might be true that a shortened life is just the life that was needed. He does say, though, that where a person passed away without children, there he thinks it's highly plausible that that means they died, you know, too young, as it were. They died, and there's some kind of a tragedy in that life, and you wouldn't give the exact name of that person to somebody else. And then he says, but if your wife, apparently, like, I think this man had a sister who had passed away at a young age, he wanted to name the baby after the sister, and he says, but if your wife doesn't want to, then you shouldn't get into fights over it, and you should work it out and find a way, and then you can just change it, like Yeshayahu to Yeshaya. There are some people who would name their kids Akiva with a hey at the end, rather than, you want to name after Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had a horrible end to his life. Right? They flayed his skin as they were burning him to death. So you didn't want to, the tradition would be not to give the name Akiva with an aleph at the end, but give the name Akiva with a hey at the end. And if you can't change the name at all for some reason, then give a second name, and that's enough to change, and that will certainly help. So that's Rav Moshe Feinstein on the fundamental question is, to me, not so interesting. Can you or can you not name somebody after certain situations? But along the way, Rav Moshe Feinstein is weighing in on what counts as a life that we'd have to be nervous about. So just the fact that somebody sadly lived to 28, if they had children already, he's not so sure. But if he's not so sure that that's necessarily a truncated life. It could be that that was the life that was destined for them, having nothing to do with sin, nothing to do with anything they did wrong. That was the time they had been given, for whatever reason, to take their place in the world, as it were. Right, so that to me was a very interesting question. And then the other issue of changing names slightly in order to be able to name people after them, or just having a second name, because that means you're not really fully naming after that person. And those are three, to me, surprising, interesting tshuvot responsive for the 15th of Tevet, the Chatam Sofer, on whether or not we have to, whether or not we really have to send away the mother bird every time we see eggs or a nest or eggs or chicks, only when we want them. Second, by Shlomo Kluger on the question of can husbands in his time actually force their wives to go on aliyah, and maybe they can't, especially if they're poor. And Rav Moshe Feinstein on the question of naming after people whose lives were, if their lives were shortened by violence, that's a tradition not to. And if their lives were just short, but they died natural deaths, so that's more of a question than the kinds of changes that would help. And that's responsibility for 15th of Tevet. With thanks to Rabbi Jacob Romowitz, David Hochhauser, and the OU. Have a great day.